Last week, I told you I was kind of shifting gears, went with a different message. You will understand why in just a little bit. It was kind of a Valentine theme last Sunday, and the point was kind of loving Christ. And this text didn't especially go well with that theme. Again, you'll see why. But I did show a little picture of Janet. I said, who's the babe on the horse? And I promised I would reintroduce that. So I'm going to ask the babe on the horse if she'll come up. And if she'll tell me a little bit, I've titled the message, Rushing Fences. And this is a term that comes from horse riding. So tell me, what is rushing your fence? There you are.
So there are many ways to rush your fences. And as a fierce person, as I was learning, I felt like, well, if I kind of fling the horse over the fence, we'll make it. And I had better let the horse go as fast as she wants because she might need that to make the fence. But I found that when you rush fences, one thing you can do is end up where the horse is going too fast to prepare well, and there's a pole here and one under the horse and one between its legs, and we're just in a terrible tangle. So that's one way that you can mess up. It isn't very pleasant. Another is you're going so fast that the horse realizes, I can't do that at this speed, so you yourself go over the fence, but the horse does not, and that doesn't feel very nice, and you have to get a new helmet, too, after that. So rushing your fences doesn't go well. The other thing is, let's say everything, somehow you got over the fence, but because you were in a rush, you didn't prepare for the next fence, which is over there, and so you're scrambling and it just doesn't go well. So the idea, you know, in any sport, it seems to happen so quickly that you can't do it well, but after a while, time slows down, and you can see, I must not look at the fence. She who looks down will eventually arrive there. You're looking at a point beyond the fence. And if the next jump is this way, you're also turning your head and putting your weight in the outside stirrup to help the horse collect for the next fence. Because in jumping, there's never just one fence. And in life, there's never just one fence. So if you blunder somehow at full speed over the first fence, getting ready for the next fence, it will come up way too fast. So rushing your fences messes with the whole course afterward. And I think, as in Sarah's life, it can change the course of your whole life afterward. And sometimes I have felt like I need to jump ahead. And finally I learned, wait for the horse to come up under you. We need to wait like that for God to do his part, because otherwise it's very ugly and painful.
So there's something really important about that. Oh, you would know all about this. Yes. About not rushing your fences, how important that is. In fact, it's dangerous at times. We're going to take a look in Genesis chapter 16. We're going to take a look at this idea of rushing fences. It's a figurative way of talking about what we're going to look at. Versus waiting for God's best in your life. Rushing fences versus waiting for God's best. Would you join me in reading? We're going to read chapter 16 in its entirety. Chapter 16 of Genesis. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abraham, the Lord has kept me from having children. Go, sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her. Abraham agreed to what Sarah had said. So after Abram had been living in Cana 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I'm suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your slave is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarai mistreated Hagar so that she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was a spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai," she answered. "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me," for she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." That is why the well is called Beer Lahai-Roi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Anything that kind of stood out to you as either new in this story or prompted a question or just something that kind of came to the top as you in this reading of God's word? Yes. Sarah seems to have passed the buck. Why,
Well, it was her idea.
It was her idea.
Abram's fault.
Great observation. Doesn't it make you want to know why? Why she did that? Any ideas? Sometimes it's easier to just let somebody else be the person responsible for the things that we're going through. Very true. Not fair, but true.
Who's mistreating who?
Yes. That would be a fair observation. They both seem to be mistreated by each other. You mentioned something about men on ladders. Wasn't it? So Doug is wondering if when Sarah brought Hagar to Abraham, if he answered wrong, instead of saying, "Oh, okay, I guess that's what we'll do," he should have said, "Oh, no, I would never do that. I would never do that." Sarah would still have been mad, probably.
And
yes.
She would have continued to nag him.
Yep. About what?
About doing what she wanted him to do.
About what she wanted done. You know, the one thing that is true, they'd waited a long time. Yes. So she's noticed that God is going out of his way to look after Hagar, an Egyptian. Not one of God's chosen people. What does that tell you? Is there something that tells you that God would do that?
He's just the
God of all.
He
so we're given a little hint here about where Hagar came from. remember Abraham and his whole family had spent some years in Egypt, had moved back up into the Canaan area, and this is like, 10 years after they had moved back. So there'd been these promises all along. There'd been promises of a son all along, and they're getting older and older, and this thing has been on Sarah's mind for a long time. Okay? Divine intervention. Let's take a look at these four ideas, I think, about rushing fences. Yes. Amita.
What does Ishmael mean?
Ishmael, God who hears, I think. I think Ishmael means God who hears. Yeah, God hears. So that's an interesting name, isn't it? God hears. Tells him, this is what his name is going to be. God hears. A reminder throughout life. God hears. You know, that's kind of a take home. You know, if you could say, there is something, there's a transferable concept. God hears. God hears when I call, when I ask. God had heard this couple through the years. And God was still unfolding his plan. But even at this point, it's tempting to rush the fences instead of sit back and let God do God's thing. So here there is an alternate idea that's hatched in the beginning of our story. And this alternate idea involves Hagar being the surrogate mother and God providing the promised child that way. When Sarah offered this, she was offering something in the known world. It was done in the known world. Someone, a person who couldn't conceive, could take one of their own servants, or the husband could, if they had, they were part of this concubine system, they could choose to have an heir come from that direction. So it's not that Sarah is completely faithless. Sarah is trying to see a solution. Okay, the question is, would Sarah have raised the child? It looks like as the chapter opens, that was Sarah's intent. That Sarah would raise the child, and she talks about kind of building her home or her house around this child. So I think that was her intent, that this child I will raise as my own. Because Hagar belongs to me, is my servant. Now, there's an interesting difference in the word servant that occurs at the beginning of this chapter and a little later in Genesis. In this passage, some think that it may be the kind of, that Hagar may have been the kind of servant, kind of like a, what would you call, an administrative secretary. That is somebody that's up closer to the thing rather than just simply, someone who comes in and cleans the house every so often. See the difference between those sort of things? So Sarah is the lady of the house, and Hagar is Sarah's servant. Some people suggest also that Sarah and Abraham both had, what would you call, inheritances, and that the wealth to have her own servant could have been her own, Sarah's own wealth. We'll get to the difference a little later, but that's how some people have treated this. They look at this as, let's say, not as a synonym. The word slave, we see it early in the chapter, and then slave as it appears later, and I'll get to that real quick. So this alternate idea develops, and the logic is kind of interesting. It must go something like this. I am without a child after all these promises from God. The only thing that I have to conclude is that the Lord is the one who's kept me from having a child. So it looks like it's up to us to figure this out. It's up to us to figure this out. Abraham, I'm going to float an idea by you. Here's my idea. You know my slave here. I will give her to you. Notice the word, as a wife. As a wife. So you go to her, sleep with her, and then she'll be your wife. Well, that made a change in status right there, to go from even administrative servant or secretary to a wife. Now, the concept here would have been, this is a secondary wife. The primary wife is Sarah. Secondary wife is Hagar. That's the way it would have been normally understood to be. But I think there's enough in this passage to indicate that things got haywire. Things got a little haywire. So, but the idea succeeds somewhat. There is a baby. Now let's take a look at the idea that there are some unintended consequences. There are many in this passage. You can see here. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. The choice of words here is quite interesting, the word despise. This is a word that God uses earlier in chapter 12 when he says, "And Abraham, after I bless you, whoever blesses you, I will bless. And whoever curses you, I will curse." And it's the same word. It's the same word. Now, whether or not she was saying it with her word, at least her body language gave evidence that she now despised the person that she was a servant to. And that message got communicated. It is the idea of loathing or despising, disapproving in a great way. I, a lowly servant, have now come up to an honored position of wife as a wife with this very powerful person. And guess what, Sarah? I'm one step above you. Why? I can have children. And you can't. And the message got there. It landed in Sarah's heart. You can see that. Yes. Okay. So Doug has noticed that it's something that would be very true. One reason why this arrangement would maybe not be recommended is because this couple, Sarah and Abraham, are now sharing another person's in their relationship. And you can't help but notice the positive that someone invests in someone else. That this could happen. It's probably easy enough to, when you're rushing your fences, to push ahead when you know you're out of balance. Is that possible? And that you're taking a risk, but you go ahead and you take the risk. Yes. It was a practice. It was a cultural practice. When you were in a situation where there would be no someone to carry on the family, or the family name. It was part of the practice in the culture, which is it's another part that I think kind of gets us to rushing our fences. Whenever we see something in culture that seems to be okay, it could be okay, but it might not be good. And we think, well, there's plenty of permission to move ahead here. Let's give it a whirl. Let's try it. See if there's a downside. Could you all hear that? Okay, sometimes we need to be very careful because there are details in the thing that are hard to know. And it takes some time kind of discerning through the details to make sure that we're on target because of the implications, the potential. And was there, what else was that? Was there anything else to that?
I was saying that sometimes God does heal.
Thank you. That's true. That's so very much part of discerning what it is, these details that God would have us attend to. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently she sensed it was a whole different thing. She was experiencing it and began to despise. You notice it says, "You're responsible for the wrong that I'm suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me." So she's saying, "You're responsible for the wrong I'm suffering." Kind of interesting. Yes.
And then she immediately calls up.
And then this, "May the Lord judge between you and me." Isn't that interesting? There's almost something here afoot that seems like missing. We're getting the Reader's Digest version of something that's going on. Part of it has to do with this change of status from slave to wife. There's no question about that. If you notice even later on in our text, Abraham really has some trouble getting moved over to the idea that this isn't the fulfillment of God's promises. He thinks maybe this might be, until he gets another solid word from the Lord that, or solemn promise that this, that it's Sarah that's going to be the one with the child. It's going to be Sarah that's the one with the child. There are some that think in between these verses, her coming the wife, and "May the Lord judge between you and me," they think that something had to have gone on that Sarah now has great concerns about her position. Yeah. Well, this is where it leads some to think maybe Abraham had made some promises about legacy to Hagar, about inheritance. Why else would she put God between him and her and say, "May the Lord judge between you and me"? Something had gone on between him and her. And she's calling God to be a witness as to what it is that's going on here now. My status has so changed that I'm not even sure. Let's see. I'm sure who I am, but I'm not sure you know who I am anymore. You are accountable to me. I'm calling God to account to arbitrate between the two of us. Yes.
For you, et cetera.
Thank you. That's a good word. That's a good word to us guys. Yes. Well, interesting that you should mention this, because in the next chapter, he does the same thing with Abimelech. He did it with the king of Egypt and now Abimelech. So there's some family issues here. Right? It's definitely some family issues. Yes? It has never been the same. Starts back here. Family issues. So there's a break here then in the couple's relationship. May the Lord judge between you and me. There's a break here of some kind that Abraham is going to resolve when he says, your slave, and he's affirming who she is now in regard to Sarah, your slave is in your hands. Do with her whatever you think. Well, then Sarah mistreats her and she flees for the first time. There's a second time she goes away. Now let's take a look at God's responses to this plan that God hatched. It didn't work out really great, but you find as she leaves, God meets her. God finds her where she is and asks the questions, where are you coming from and where are you going? The place the text talks about it suggests that she's about 100 miles away, headed toward Egypt, maybe back toward home. That may be where she was going. She doesn't answer that part, but she says where she's come from, and she's fleeing her mistress. And so God engages her with those questions. God instructs her in verse 9, go back to your mistress and submit to her. So in a sense, she's having to recommit to her status, isn't she? She has to recommit to her status when he says, go back and submit to her. Why would God do this? Why would he send her back? I can think of a few things, but one is that there's the raising of a child and the caretaking of both child and mother. I think that's one reason. Yes? So God could be glorified. Yes, and especially the way he worked it out. Yes. So there's that issue. God instructs her. God promises her that she's pregnant and will have a son. So in her near future, there is that. And that she is to call him Ishmael, which means God will hear or God hears. And then he tells the story about what Ishmael's going to be like. He's going to be a wild donkey. There's another word we use. He's going to be a wild donkey of a man. And he's not going to get along with anybody. And people aren't going to get along with him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. Now, he's going to have other brothers. And one is going to be Isaac. There's going to be this hostility. Notice how the family's in trouble here. Family's couple trouble, family trouble, extended family trouble, and that this is going to go on for some time. And so, huh? And now it's worldwide. Yeah, in a sense, yes. And even toward family members. And he's going to... What we're told in the second leaving is that there was a day when Sarah was watching Ishmael and her son, Isaac. It was the day he was weaned. They were throwing a great big party for this little boy. And on that day, Ishmael did something that displeased Sarah. Some translations you may have say they were laughing and having a good time. But the sense of the text is that he laughed at Isaac. That he, in a sense, made fun of him. He disparaged him, much like his mother disparaged Sarah. And Sarah saw this, and she wanted it no more. So she went to Abraham and said, you send this slave and her son away. She uses a different word for slave here. And some have suggested that it is more like the second term I gave you, comes in and cleans the place up. you know, a servant like this, not a executive secretary. That in Sarah's mind and eyes, even when she came back, Hagar was demoted well beyond below being a second wife. And these two get sent out into the desert. Abraham's distraught. He thinks, well, he spent a lot of time with this 13-year-old named Ishmael. He's kind of wondered if this was going to be God's answer for the promised child, because even in this future chapter, he says, oh, that Ishmael might be blessed. And God says, he will be blessed. I'll take care of him. I'll take care of her. But what I'm talking about now is that you're going to be blessed through Sarah, and you're going to have a son, and his name is Isaac. So Abraham is worried about this. God reassures him that everything's going to be okay, and God makes good on that. There's an initial bump in the road, but the mother and son begin to live in the desert. He grows up and becomes a mighty archer. His mother finds him a wife from Egypt, not from Abraham's family, but from Egypt. So you can begin to see already a dynamic where this is a fractured family, people sent away, that there's not only physical but emotional cutoff between the family members. And this is part of what is the trouble with this whole solution. It looks designed to end up that way, doesn't it? Well, what we know about love, what we know about caring for people, about the selectiveness of marital love that says, I'm yours, and I'm yours alone, and I'm yours forever. Those are things that this kind of an arrangement makes a mess of. So Ishmael's future is talked about. And then the last idea where it says God enlightens in verses 13 through 16, Hagar then understands this God who's just watched out and looked for me is the God who sees me in my circumstances. You are the God who sees me, she says. She actually gives God a name. It's Elroy. So have you ever heard of the name Elroy? Okay, just use that to kind of cement this in. El means God, and Roy means sees, God who sees. Elroy, God who, he is the God who sees. Not only is he talked about as a God who sees, but he is a God who finds people, enlightens people. This becomes for her a new moment of understanding the nature of God. God sees me. And then this place is named Beer Lahai Roy, as the well where she experienced this. Beer Lahai Roy is named, this well is named, the well of the one who sees me. And then she gets a new start by resubmitting first to God and going back and fulfilling God's call on her life. What could you say we could learn from this story? What are some learning points here for us today? Just because the culture does it, okay? Don't jump the gun. Okay? Okay. Anything else? Accepting your loss? Lot. Okay? Okay. Don't get ahead of God. Well, I'll just give you one thing that I thought was very interesting. You find later on, and I don't know if it ever improved, but later on in Abraham's life, when he's passed away, Isaac and Ishmael both bury him. And I don't know if there was healing there in the family, but you kind of hope that there was some kind of healing between the two. In regard to the idea that you don't take your cues from, well, what's going on around you, let me give you an example. Polyamory. Can you describe polyamory? What's that?
Many loves.
Many loves, okay. So the couples, the trouble, that they call them troubles now, that's depicted here is a man and two women who are in a understanding. They're in an understanding where they live together, and there is, in this understanding, for example, if any one of the women decided that they wanted to also have another person in the mix, they could just negotiate it. Okay? Now, why am I showing you this? Well, this was kind of polyamorous, the setting that we were talking about. But I read an article recently in what's called in Christianity Today. It says, the next sexual frontier that Christians will address is polyamory. And they will address it because Christians in their churches will be talking about it as a live option. And the reason they are projecting that is because it's already happening. And there, I have a story here about Taylor and Amanda, who married. They were grew up in a Christian home and lived in the Bible Belt, high school sweethearts. And they decided, well, to invite a friend to come and stay with them. And Amanda developed feelings for the other friend. And so they renegotiated a new relationship. And in this world where, see, it's reasoned out this way. As long as everybody understands it and it's consensual, there's nothing wrong with it. I see some heads shaking, but that's the logic. As long as it doesn't hurt anyone else, as long as it is consensual, what could be the problem with it? The article talks about them going to a Christian counselor who said, this is okay. This is okay. And I think if you look deeply into this story, you'll find out that there are all kinds of hidden things that this couple, Sarah and Abraham, could never have anticipated. And I think the couples today who are experimenting here are not anticipating what could happen. We're trying social experiments, breaking down walls very quickly in our culture anymore, that I think probably ought not be messed with. But we're doing it blindly. And it's just simply, as long as it's kind and considerate and mutual and out in the open, it's got to be okay. That's not the standard for us as followers of Christ, but it's coming. And it may be that you and I will have an opportunity sometime when lives unravel because it's not working well, because people rush their fences, in a sense, into this new lifestyle to help pick up the pieces.
Things are not.
Yes, so that's very, it's true that we need to be open to persons to help them when there's skid marks in their lives, okay? When there's skid marks in their lives. And I'm just bringing this up because I do think that the biblical situation actually speaks to a situation that could be developing in our culture. Let's pray. Well, Heavenly Father, this couple, we identify with some of the things that have gone on in their lives. We realize that they were trying, best as they knew how, to have a family and to see how that was going to happen. And most of us as family couples have been at a point where we make an error in judgment and it affects us as family and a couple. Would you come alongside us in the pain that sometimes we cause and help see us through as you did Sarah and as you did Abraham and especially as you did Hagar. We rejoice that you watch over us even in our mistakes when we miss it, that you can be there and will be there for us. Do please help us to be the same, to be come alongside those who are suffering because of choices that have so many unintended results, and help us to be there for them and encourage them to trust in your good news, first in your forgiveness, and second in the wonder of your Holy Spirit walking with them day by day. We ask these things in the wonderful name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.